This spring, thousands of our fellow citizens will convene in our capital for the White House Conference on Children and Youth. This conference is a unique, an unusual, and quite praiseworthy feature of American life. Every 10 years, our president convenes the citizens of our country to discuss what is, after all, our most basic and vital national resource, the state of our youth. Each community assesses the services which it is tendering to its young people, services which ought to be tendered, and a giant inventory is compiled in Washington. And out of this inventory, the local communities and the government and the individual citizen plan what ought to be done to make this country an even better and more wonderful world for our children. The first of these decennial conferences was convened by President Theodore Roosevelt in the year 1910. At that first conference, some very elemental legal and economic problems had to be faced and met. And if one wishes to know how far we have progressed in making this country a paradise for our young people, one has only to look back at 50 years of accomplishment. The first problem which faced this first conference was the problem of child labor. Economic want had forced many in the laboring classes to send their children into the mines and the factories at an early age. In England in the 19th century, it was not at all unusual for the children of the poorer classes to work in the mines and in the fields and the factories 7 days a week, 12 to 16 hours a day from the ages of 7, 8, and 9 years. And even in America in the year 1910, a year many, I'm sure, who are here this morning can remember, even in 1910, 12% of all the workers in our textile factories were under 15 years of age, and 8% of all those who mined our coal were under 16. So great progress had to be made in establishing minimum standards of schooling, and seeing to it that parents were not forced by economic necessity to put their children out into the vocational fields before it was necessary. And this has been the preeminent concern of our country from that day to this. And it is a concern which we have met rather successfully. Today, less than 1% of those under 16 are employed on a full-time basis. And these largely from our newer in-migrant groups and from the migratory workers. None of them are employed in our basic industries or resources. Our higher standard of living, trade unionization, the establishment of a United States Children's Bureau with supervisory capacities to oversee this program. The establishment by the several states of minimum standards for education, the requirement that a child must be in school until he is 16. All of these factors have contributed virtually to eliminate child labor from our scene, that greatest of all blights, which grayed out the sunlight of childhood. A child labor was born out of poverty. But poverty contributed to blight the sunlight of childhood in more than this one way. Raised in a slum, surrounded by poverty and misery, by disease and by filth, living in homes where both of the parents had to work because of economic necessity, children of the poorer classes were obviously not enabled to enjoy much of life's golden youthful opportunity. So the second major concern of these White House conferences has been the general concern with raising the standard of living of all of our people. We're seeing to it that economic need does not force any child into a life of penury, misery, coarseness, and want. And here, too, much has been done. Federal programs of aid to dependent children, social security programs, unemployment insurance, unemployment compensation, urban renewal and public housing programs, private programs of direct aid to needy families, private programs of vocational guidance, of scholarship and the like. All these have contributed to making it possible for every child to share basically in the blessing and the prosperity that is America. Few children in America today are forced to cut their school radically short. Few are blighted by poverty and lack the basic necessities of life. But much here remains to be done. If the standard of living from that 50% of the American people who were in our lowest income brackets in 1910 is now four times what it was in that day, it still remains true that only 2 years ago, during the late recession, teachers from the school one block from our temple had to come here to plead with us to get shoes and clothing that their young students might come to school. Many parents still live on the edge of poverty. 132,500 young people in the state of Ohio are receiving state aid. And with the spiraling cost of inflationary living, the dollars which they receive must be stretched further and further until they hardly cover the necessities of life. And if we are determined that every child must be raised in a decent, clean home in decent, fine surroundings, then our nation must bestir itself even more to eradicate poverty and the misery that it breeds. But here, too, the record of accomplishment of the last 50 years is a dramatic one, one in which we can, as Americans, take great pride. If the record of our country in combating poverty and in outlawing child labor has been a dramatic and substantial one, none has been more dramatic or praiseworthy than our battle against ill health among our children. In 1910, 30% of our children never received a physical examination and never saw a doctor in all of their childhood. Epidemics were endemic. There were few pediatric clinics, and these were often not available to the children. Many schools lacked rudimentary clinics. Most schools lacked a physical hygiene and personal hygiene program. Largely today, this has totally been eradicated. All of our schools have clinics with staff by competent nurses and doctors. There are annual and semi-annual physical examinations. There are diagnostic tests for sight and for hearing, and remedial programs are developed for our children in these respects. Each of the schools has a physical fitness program, a mental hygiene program. A great deal of work has been done through the schools and through the PTAs in teaching the basic elements of hygiene to all of our families. Immunization has largely been successful against many of our childhood wasting diseases, and as medical science improves, these programs will be continued and enlarged. Here above all, American science and American know-how and American generosity have contributed to a great achievement. The child death rate, infant mortality, has dropped from more than 110 per thousand in 1910 to less than 29 per thousand in 1950. No longer need a child suffer from a curable disease and be bent and broken and crippled for life. Something remains to be done, largely in the area of serious crippling disease, birth abnormalities, serious hearing and sight defects, osteopathic defects, which often require a great deal more in terms of monetary help than a family is able to tender. But increasingly, our schools are undertaking programs for the handicapped child. And as we look forward to the next decade, we look forward with confidence that this area of public health will equally be met. This is the record of accomplishment which the inventory of American childhood will lay before our government and our people this spring. But will the record be one only of achievement? Will there be no negative? Are there no sobering challenges, no crises which face America as we think of our youth? Yes, there are. There is one index which has plunged downward, as all the other indices of health, mental, physical, emotional, economic, have gone upward. That is the index of delinquent behavior. In the last 20 years, since the end of the Second World War, delinquency has almost tripled in proportion to our population. This year, 600,000 cases of delinquent behavior involving 500,000 young people will be brought before the courts of our land. It can safely be predicted today that out of every 10 children passing their 10th birthday this year, one of these children will be before the courts on a charge of delinquency before he is 17 years of age. This is a sobering, dramatic sight. Delinquency is now no longer limited to the center city, to the slum. It encompasses all the areas of our community, our suburbs, our exurbs, our urban and semi-rural areas. It is rising, as a matter of fact, more swiftly in our rural areas today than in the city itself. And not only is it rising, but there are other statistics which concern us. 60% of those who are committed by the states to serve various sentences for delinquent behavior graduate into some form of adult crime. And according to a survey made by the state of Ohio in 1956, 55% of those who are committed need not have been committed if there had been adequate child guidance and therapy clinics and personnel in their own communities. There is an almost absolute lack, a dearth, a vacuum of competent personnel and agencies to deal with delinquent behavior. According to the Ohio report, which will be submitted to Washington, 23 of the 33 probation offices of the juvenile courts in our state are undermanned. All of the youth bureaus in our state are undermanned. Hardly a beginning has been made in sending recreation officers, youth leaders, group workers, caseworkers into high delinquency areas to cope with these problems. Now, why is this so? This is so because of two other problems which face us when we think of youth. One is a crisis of costs, and the other a crisis of personnel. We have lived for 20 years in a highly prosperous country, but our country has been undergoing inflation. And whereas some of us can, by virtue of exertion, effort, keep pace in our income with this inflation, this is not possible of lower income families or of our charitable and public agencies. Their dollars are stretched thinner and thinner until they break. Actually, our community fund in Cleveland receives less dollar per individual served and per service offered than it did in 1945. Actually, less dollar per child served by our juvenile courts, our probation bureaus, and our child guidance centers is available today than was available in 1945. The sums have gone up. But because of our population explosion, the service must be extended, and because of the rising costs of living, the service costs more. This problem, as taxpayers and as contributors to private charities, we shall have to meet with greater generosity. And I'm sure that we will meet this crisis. But the crisis of personnel cannot be solved as simply. There is not an agency in our community, our schools, nor our libraries, nor our recreation services, nor our family service associations, nor our welfare federations, nor our courts as far as they deal with caseworkers and group workers, that has not a help wanted sign hanging prominently from its walls. There are simply less people today to do these very essential jobs than there were 20, 30, 40 years ago. And our population has doubled and trebled in that time. Now, why is this so? It is so because our economy is based on financial success. It is so largely because a child who desires to be a teacher is met by his parent with, "How can you make a living?" When the answer is an obvious one, you can make a living and you can enjoy a fulfilling life. But you must recognize that you will have to cut down on your desires, restrict your impulse buying, set a little bit lower the standards of housing and of community and of purchases which you make for yourselves. And perhaps, certainly, the satisfaction which will come to you in being of service will far outweigh the restrictions that that you have to put upon yourselves as to the material possessions that you can acquire. This is a problem for our whole culture. Our culture is a business culture, and it will have to again become a culture which deals with human beings as much as it deals with material commodities. And until it does, we will be faced with this crisis of personnel. We will have to, yes, increase the wages which are offered to all of these workers. But more important even than that, we will have to give status in our own eyes and in the eyes of our community to these professions. These are not people to be looked down on, to be sympathized with, to be patronized. Rather, these are the true champions of democracy, who more than any other group in our society are giving of themselves, placing themselves in the forefront of the fight, the struggle to achieve a fine and blessed land of free people. Which brings me to the larger problem of delinquency itself. Delinquency cannot be solved, as we all recognize, simply by voting more money, by giving more charity, and by finding more people to work and to combat it directly. Delinquency is rather a problem which affects our whole society. The eminent European sociologist Emil Durkheim says that delinquency rises insofar as a society disintegrates. He calls this the principle of anomie. When there is a gap between what a society says it believes and what it shows it believes in practice, when there is this disorientation, this lack of equilibrium between our protestations, our professions of faith, and our acts, our proofs of faith, then the child growing in this society is forced to make a decision between the values he sees his parents adopt, the values he sees succeed in his community, and the values which his church or his culture claims ought to be his. He is asked to be a schizophrenic personality, to live in two worlds, to accept a burden of responsibility which he knows is not accepted by all those whom he respects and whom he sees succeeding about him. And out of this disorientation of the youthful personality, out of his inability to know exactly what is expected of him, the conventional moralities which are mouthed, or the conventional immoralities which are practiced, the child becomes antisocial in his behavior, delinquent, and that pattern of aggressive activity sets in, which leads him often into our courts. Now, if Durkheim is correct, if the rise in the level of delinquency coincides with a breakdown in the fabric of one's culture and one's value, this is the most damning criticism which can be made of our American way of life at this point in our history. For the rise in delinquent behavior is dramatic. And if we are honest with ourselves, does it not coincide with a breakdown of morals during the Second World War? With a lack of moral indignation which has been part and parcel of our political and national way of life ever since? Haven't we been ingenious beyond belief in explaining and exculpating everyone who has set personal interest above the social welfare? Haven't we found every reason to claim that the schools ought to be educating our children, the churches and synagogues, the recreational societies, the scouting and youth organizations and the like? And at the same time, haven't we made our homes cafeterias and hotels and nothing more? Haven't we indulged our every whim at the same time that we have asked our children to consecrate themselves and to dedicate themselves to ideals, democracy, freedom, liberty, which we in our lives have shown little allegiance to? This then is our challenge. The problem of delinquency is a challenge which must be met in every American home and by every American family. And I am pleased that the White House Conference on Children and Youth is making its opening program one which is concerned with the ethical and spiritual values of family life. I should like to quote you from the fine summation of this problem which will be presented in Washington by our own state. There must be greater emphasis on the strengthening of the ethical and moral values of the American family, the community, and the nation. Our children need to have a greater opportunity to develop a set of cultural and moral values which will enable them to live in their community with relative stability, sense of purpose, and personal satisfaction. Where do children get their ideals? From the people with whom they live and learn, principally from their parents, from their teachers, from their religious leaders and others. Obviously, the behavior of these people is the most significant to the child. The teaching office of the parent is considered the basis of providing such opportunities to their children. Parents are the first and natural teachers of their children. The child needs the example of high moral standards in his parents' behavior, a model for his own future. If the parents have ideals, if they live with them, the impact and value will be registered in their children. The failure or neglect of some adults to adhere to firm moral values, to teach these in the home, deprives children and youth of effective support where it is needed the most. These moral values and others, respect for people, for lawful authority, for learning, for excellence, all need to be taught to a greater degree by parents in the family setting. The teaching office of the parents must be maintained and further strengthened. Children and youth hardly can be expected to live by values any nobler or more consistent than those of their parents or the rest of the adult community. Religious morality is important to society as well as the individual. Morality and the advancement of religious principles, therefore, have civic and social implications which should be the concern of all citizens. These should have a prominent place in community thought and community programs. The behavior of adults and the moral climate of the community must conform more to the traditional moral and spiritual ideals of our religious faith. The mass media, radio, television, newspapers, magazines, entertainment should reflect a greater social responsibility in extending and perpetuating basic values in our society. This is essential if our children and youth are to incorporate sound values into their lives. Well, this then, my friends, is our challenge and our problem. Unlike the problems of child labor and public health and poverty, it cannot be met by an economic or legal crash program. And yet I submit to you that the moral gap which exists in our society between what we know our society ought to be and our homes ought to be and what we recognize that they are, is as detrimental to the long-range security of our nation as is the missile gap which exists between us and the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, protestations at a national level will do little unless each of us is willing, is sympathetic, is ready to accept a new discipline in his life. For delinquency begins with us, with what we do, and what we say, and what we practice, and how we act as parents, and how we act as leaders in our community. And if we want a new sense of responsibility among our young people, let us begin by accepting a new sense of responsibility among ourselves. You remember the line from the book of Proverbs that I read this morning, where there is no vision, the people perish. Where there is no vision, society begins to fractionalize, to disintegrate, and to break apart. We again need a vision. Our children need to sense that vision in us, the adults whom they revere and whom they love and whom they pattern their lives after. And if you would doubt this, if you would doubt the effect which a lack of vision in us, a lack of sense of nobility in the parent, I would submit to you answers which were given impromptu to Mr. Art Linkletter on a nationally broadcast program some months ago. He asked some 10-year-olds, what was the difference between youth, between middle age, and old age? The Bible says, the young men shall dream dreams. These 10-year-olds said, when you're young, you have school troubles. When you're middle-aged, you have husband trouble. When you're old, you have heart trouble. Another, when you're young, you're in the way of your parents. When you're middle-aged, you're in the way of your wife. When you're old, you're in everybody's way. When you're young, another said, you learn all about school. When you're middle-aged, all you do is worry about payments. When you're old, you're good for nothing but babysitting. I know of no more damning criticism of our American lack of vision, of our American home, than these impromptu words of our own young people. What must they see in their homes which makes them old beyond their years, cynical when they ought to be full of vision? Coarseness, banality, meanness, not dignity and pride. What bickering must be in their homes when there ought to be a consideration of the opportunities of life? What quarreling when they ought to sense the magnificence and of the beauty of the world in which they live? Another young child, a 5-year-old, was asked on the same program how old she was, and she said 5, and she was asked how old she would like to be. And the answer was 9,000. 9,000 years old, isn't that an old age for such a young girl? Why would you like to be 9,000? Because I'd be dead. Why would you like to be dead? Because being dead, it would be so peaceful. I wouldn't have to hear my mother and father quarreling all the time. We must give our young people life, not death. A vision, not a frustration. To give our young people these, we must find them again in our lives. We will find them as we commit ourselves to values. And if this White House Conference on Children of Youth of 1960 does nothing else, I pray, and I'm sure that you join me in the prayer, that it will spark and catalyze a new commitment on the part of our American people, something which has always been very precious in our country's heritage, a moral tradition, a sense of spiritual fineness, which has somehow been wanting and lacking in our society in the past generation. Amen.